Please be seated. The third case for oral argument this morning is Midland Farms Appellants versus Dowling Family Partnership Appellee. For the appellants, we have Mr. William Taylor and Mr. James Moore, attorneys from Sioux Falls. Mr. Taylor, I understand you'll be presenting this morning. Very well. And for the appellees, we have Mr. Greg Eastland, an attorney from Rapid City. The court should note that Justices Wilbur and Kern have disqualified themselves in this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable Joni Cutler, a judge from the Second Judicial Circuit, and the Honorable Robert Spears, a judge from the Third Judicial Circuit, to sit in their place. With that, Mr. Taylor, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Justices. Mr. Eastland. This case started out as a lease dispute, a contest between Midland Farms Limited Liability Company and Scott Dowling, who did business as Dowling Partners. It started in the summer of 2012. The property in question is a 33,000-acre farm in Haakon County, north of Midland, about 25 miles. The farm consists of four units. There are two pieces commonly called Philip East and Philip West, about 6,000 acres just in the Philip vicinity. There's about 24,000 acres essentially inside of one fence north of Midland that is the main farm and where the farm headquarters are. And then there's a fourth unit commonly called Plum Creek that's north of the main unit and is about 3,500 acres. Mr. Dowling, first of all, Midland Farms is a partnership. The principal of Midland Farms are the DeMotts. Lanny DeMott is a 70-plus-year-old farmer and realtor from eastern Iowa. His son, Scott DeMott, is a middle-40s farmer and insurance agent from Little Rock. They bought this property along with a couple of South Dakota investors and one Iowa investor about 5 years before this trouble started. The DeMotts had leased the property to Mr. Dowling. This was the 2012 year was the third year that they had been involved with Mr. Dowling at various levels of leasing. They'd had some crop share leases. They had had a couple of other leases. The key issue that comes up in this contest is in the lease that covered the 2012 crop year was a provision that said landlord will give tenant the option to rent the leased premises for 2013, 14, and 15 crop year. Terms and conditions to be agreed to by landlord and tenant. Terms and conditions to be agreed to by landlord and tenant. That phrase is the genesis of this lawsuit. In the spring of 2012, Scott DeMott asked Mr. Dowling if he was interested in negotiating to extend the lease for the 3 years pursuant to the phrase that I just read you from the lease. There were some discussions back and forth. Mr. Dowling proposed $55 an acre, the then extant rent. DeMott said no. They thought that the land was worth more than that. Some time went past. The DeMotts shopped the property, if you will, and determined that there were renters who would pay $70 an acre. So in the middle of the summer of 2012, they had a discussion with Mr. Dowling, and Mr. Dowling said that he was willing to pay $70 per acre to take the property for the coming three crop years. The DeMotts had had some collection problems with a previous tenant, tenant who had gone bankrupt. The rent on this farm would be plus $2 million. So the DeMonts said in the course of that discussion, we need security for the rent. The security for the rent that they asked for was a bank letter of credit in the amount of the rent, $2 million. The bank letter of credit would be put in place at the commencement of the lease. The first rental payment would be due in February of the year following, and the letter of credit would secure and assure that that rental payment would be made. They never came to terms with Mr. Dowling on that subject. In early August of 2012, they came to the essential terms of the balance of the contract. They agreed on the rent. They agreed on the property, identified the property, but they did not agree on the security for the rent. DeMonts had another tenant in the wings, a tenant with whom they had previously done business, Mr. Clement. Conrad Clement is a farmer from Iowa who has farmed all over North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, large-scale operator. Clement was leasing the Plum Creek ground, the 3,000-plus acres north of the main body of the farm from him at the time. Clement said he would go $70 an acre and supply a bank letter of credit to secure his rental obligation. Negotiations extended back and forth during the month of August. Finally, the DeMonts said, we have to plant winter wheat. You got to get started planting winter wheat. There are 24,000 acres that could be planted to winter wheat. Can't do that overnight. We got to get going. So they told Dowling that they were going to go with Clement. Now, they didn't do this in a vacuum. As the record shows, prior to that, they consulted with their lawyer, Mr. Jensen from Rapid City, who advised them that since they had no written lease in place with Mr. Dowling, that they were not bound to his obligation. So, Clement planted about 12,000 acres of winter wheat. He started mid-September. Understand that winter wheat has to be in the ground and planted by October 15th. The federal crop insurance program says October 15th is the cutoff date for insuring fall planted winter wheat. After October 15th, for the next 15 days, coverage goes down 1% per day, and after 15 days, no coverage. So nobody in their right mind who farms these days takes a risk of not having federal crop insurance. Mr. Clement started out, put 12,000 acres of winter wheat planted in the ground between early mid-September and October. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, there's a fight going on between the DeMonts and the Dowlings over whether or not there is a lease in place. That fight gets taken to Judge Devaney. Judge Devaney, Dowling is out of possession. Judge Devaney decides in February that the essential terms of the lease had been successfully negotiated, that there was adequate writing to satisfy the statute of frauds, and accordingly, she put Dowling back in possession. DeMonts, per their agreement with Clement, paid Clement the cost of planting 12,000 acres of wheat, which was $1.1 million. That spring, after Mr. Dowling took possession of the property, he also took possession of the winter wheat, assessed it, decided that it was worth pursuing, fertilized it, took it to harvest. From the winter wheat, he got $500,000 for some acres that he hayed. He got $1.5 million in a crop insurance indemnity, and that's $1.5 million net of his premium that he paid for the crop insurance. And he had about 100,000 bushels of wheat in the bin at the time worth $5, $6 per bushel. So he accrued in excess of $2 million of revenue from the winter wheat that Clement planted.
Did the trial court's decision address at all what was to be done with the wheat that had been planted?
Did not.
Okay.
Nor did the stipulation that the parties entered into while the case was pending address that issue. But I wasn't their lawyer then, so I don't know what the thinking was at that time. All right, so Dowling's make a demand, or DeMont's make a demand on Dowling. They make this point. They say you're unjustly enriched. We paid Clement $1 million for the cost of putting that seed in the ground. You, Dowling, had said that you were going to plant the whole place of winter wheat anyway. Clement planted the exact same variety that Dowling would have planted on the exact same acres that Dowling would have planted. The only difference is Clement put starter fertilizer on in the fall, which required Dowling to put a heavy dose of fertilizer on in the spring. Dowling had the benefit of the crop and took the money for the crop, but never paid for the planting. So we end up in court on two issues. First, we don't think there was a lease, and we think Judge Devaney was incorrect in her decision that the essential terms of the contract were reached and met in August of 2012. And second, even if Judge Devaney was correct that the DeMonts should have been paid the $1 million or at least a fair sum for the cost of the seed that was put in the ground. As to the lease, everybody knows and nobody argues that in South Dakota you can satisfy the parole evidence rule with something other than an official written contract, that the parole evidence rule can be met by writings between the parties that establish the essential terms of the lease agreement. Absent a finding that the essential terms of the lease agreement are met, there is no lease. In this case, Judge Devaney ruled that the phrase "landlord will give tenant an option to rent the lease premises, terms and conditions to be agreed by landlord and tenant," she found that was ambiguous. It required interpretation and accordingly extrinsic evidence. We think quite to the contrary. With all due respect to Judge Devaney, I think she got lost in the fog of the combat between the parties. The extrinsic evidence that should have been offered was evidence to demonstrate A, what the terms were that the parties discussed, and B, the foundation for the writing that established the lease to satisfy the parole evidence rule. That's all the evidence that had to be taken, and there was no ambiguity in the lease agreement. What is ambiguous about terms and conditions to be agreed to by landlord and tenant?
All right. What I found, I'm assuming from the action, that the lease was provided by your client, by Mott's. I don't know who drafted it, but it was drafted either by them or for them.
The 2012 lease.
Correct.
Yes, correct.
So any ambiguity, is construed against them, is it not?
Of course, but there has to be an ambiguity first.
Okay.
You know, the challenge that I pose and Mr. Moore and I have posed, go ahead.
Well, for one thing, it says option, and Mr. Mott testified that this should be construed repeatedly. He testified that this should be construed as a right of first refusal.
The option, the relationship between the parties has at various times been called an option or a right of first refusal. But the contract says landlord will give tenant option to rent leased premises, terms and conditions to be agreed on by landlord and tenant. Now, it's not a lawyer-drafted lease, and you can tell that when you look at it.
Well, that's not our problem. That's their problem.
No, of course. I understand that. But the word option has a legal meaning, and it has a meaning in the vernacular also. And this clearly wasn't an option in the legal meaning because there was no option to exercise. In order to be an option to exercise, there has to be an established price. There has to be, all of the terms have to be established, and then I have to say to you, the holder of the option, at your option, do you take these terms or not? Mm-hmm. In this case, it said terms and conditions to be agreed on by landlord and tenant. And it was that process that was undertaken in August of 2012. If there were an agreement, then Dowling can't have it both ways. He says, first in his testimony, when asked, well, why didn't you post the letter of credit so we wouldn't have this conflict? His answer was, I didn't have to. I had no lease in front of me that required a letter of credit. But then in the next breath, offers testimony and proof that he had the financial capacity to provide the letter of credit, which was the linchpin last piece of this agreement.
But Judge Devaney was also presented with evidence that your client thought you did have an agreement. There were emails saying, how do you want your name on the agreement? So isn't that ambiguity? I mean, isn't there, obviously, there's evidence going both ways on this.
Well, there's no ambiguity. There's no ambiguity in the phrase in the lease.
Okay.
What there is a need to divine whether or not the parties' minds had been met. And the parole evidence rule requires that there be a writing to establish that if you're going to make the lease without the lease, which is what Judge Devaney tried to do. She got lost in the evidence struggle. What evidence are we supposed to offer? Well, the evidence we got to offer is DeMont's got to say, here's what we talked about. Dowling's got to say, here's what we talked about. And somebody has to say, here's the foundation for the writing that satisfies the parole evidence rule. We didn't do any of that in this case. Now, we think no lease. Case is over at that point.
Are you saying that because there was no meeting of the minds or because of the parole evidence rule?
Well, it could be one of two things. It could be that there was no meeting of the minds. They either never agreed on whether or not a letter of credit was required, or it could be they agreed that a letter of credit was required and Dowling didn't satisfy it. So either way, either Dowling breached or there was no agreement because there's no dispute that there was no letter of credit. I want to talk a little bit about unjust enrichment. When the case was tried, Mr. Dowling made a claim for $3 million of damages as a consequence of being put off the land. The judge ruled against him on that point. Our counterclaim was for the cost of planting the wheat. The defense raised was, you had dirty hands. You breached the lease. You had dirty hands. A claim for unjust enrichment is an equity claim, and if you've got dirty hands, you can't make an equity claim. Except that South Dakota law says that while unclean hands is a defense to a claim for unjust enrichment, the dirt on your hands has to be acquired in the process of getting the rights that you now assert. There's one case on that point in South Dakota, and it's a fine distinction. Adrian versus McKinney is the case. All the other cases of significance in the cases cited by Judge Devaney are instances where there was a breach of contract, and the guy who breached made a claim for a benefit under the contract that he had breached. This is entirely separate from that. What this case is, we breached, no doubt about it, if you believe what Judge Vaney's ruling. It kind of is like what is said in Adrian versus McKinney. No matter how wrong DeMont's acts were, those acts have nothing to do with what happened here. What happened here is Clement planted wheat. The wheat sprouted just like it would have done if Dowling had planted it. It went dormant just like it would have done with Dowling. In the springtime, it came back to life. By then, Dowling had possession of the property, and he made the assessment. What am I going to do? He spent the money to fertilize it. He took it to harvest. He got the money from the harvest and kept it, except he didn't have to pay for the seed and planting and the fall fertilizing, which is $1 million. We think that Judge Devaney was wrong in her determination that there was a link between the alleged breach of the lease and the planting of the wheat, and that therefore the DeMott's hands were dirty. And we think that that point should be reversed, that there should be an award of damages to whatever the fair and reasonable value and cost of planting that wheat was. Surrender the floor to my colleague, Mr. Easley.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Mr. Easley, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court and counsel. If the facts were exactly like counsel said it, maybe it was a little bit different. But the facts are set out in Judge Devaney's findings of fact, and very extensive findings of fact. What happened here is there was an agreement. There was a haggling over the price. For years and years, Mr. Dowling had rented this at $55 an acre, and now if he was going to get this option, Midland said, we wanted 70. And they were haggling back and forth like a farmer and the landowner would, and finally Mr. Dowling says, what do I have to do to match it? $70. He calls on August 1st and says, I'll meet it, $70. And they come to an agreement. Meeting of the minds. He's already done 5 years of crops there. They've already got an agreement that they're working on. This is just an extension of that agreement for 13, 14, and 15. Then what happens is, and it's very important, that August 6th email. That says, what name do you want on our farm lease? There is a farm lease, and they say it on August 6th. Midland says, what do you want on our farm lease? What name? Because he was in the process with his brother, changing names as to who the lease was. But Dowling was the farmer that was handling it. And so he sends back to them on the 9th and says what name it should be. They recite the price for the years, the whole part. There is an agreement, but what happened between that was a buyer came in and offered $42 million. This was a $16 million profit in less than 5 years for them. And that's fine. They're investors. They buy and sell land, and they're there to make money. But there's an inconvenience, which was my client, who had a 3-year lease. Now they're in there at everything they can do to get out of that lease. We go from, on August 9th, talking about the contract and the terms and everything that's going, until August 13th, when we get the email, and going, you don't have it. There is no lease. We're selling this. And get off the property, don't do any more work. And that's the email. That's how that thing changed in 4 to 5 days. And from then on, it's been this battle of wanting they're reaching for the golden ring as investors of what they can do, and they need to get rid of Dowling. Because the new fellow, Clement, wants to start farming it right away, or at least send one of his crews, his people, to come out and farm this. To get this deal to go, to keep this $42 million, because he's offered to do this, he's not going to get his financing, he says, until November 15th. But I want to get started, I want to get going. Mr. Dowling meets him there on the property and says, don't plant. I've got this lease. And they have a discussion. It's not a heated discussion, but Mr. Clement says, that's not what the Midland people tell me. They said you didn't exercise your option. And he says, well, I sure did. And I've got the right to be here. And he's going, you're doing this, and it's in the testimony of Clement. He goes, you're doing this at your own risk. This is risky business, planting on another man's property. He goes, I'm against it. Leave. And he says, I'm going to do it. That's all the conversation we had. Now we have an order to be off the property. And that's how this case gets going. They were at the place where they gave then, because evidently Clement got nervous. And he says, look, if I'm going to put all of this in here, I want to know if this Dowling fellow wins on this, I want to get my money back. So here's what Midland says. Tell you what we'll do. If he gets it, we'll pay you back your $1 million. And they put it in there. They put in a golden parachute. Not only will we put in $1 million, he goes, plus another $100,000, just for your inconvenience. So now Clement has, okay, I'll go ahead and do it. And he went in there. It is probably the most expensive planting that has been done in this area as far as putting in wheat. And he does not, he's not a wheat farmer. He's corn, soybeans, kind of a farmer from Iowa and Minnesota. And he's got some people, some local people, but there's no coordination in this. And they come in and they only end up, before they run out of seed, they get in 12,000 acres. And what's found out later when we get in possession, not only that, they have left a hole in the middle of their field, 1,800 acres, 3 square miles, that has nothing in it. It's called the donut hole. It became during this case. The donut hole in there with nothing. So here you have 29,000 acres, 12,000 of them planted. The rest of them, it's just a mess. We win on this, and the court finds that, yes, you did have an agreement. There was a meeting of the minds. Here is all the correspondence. It says the price on here, the parties, the term. It's all right here. You do have an option, and you do get that property back.
What about the letter of credit?
On the letter of credit, and he says, I will when, and it's the custom and usage. When we have a contract signed, within a few days, you do. Here's the identical contract that they did with Clement. And it says in here, letter of credit within 5 days of the execution date of the contract, which is what is always done. And that's not any different than what had been done. You give a letter of credit once you can walk into the bank and go, here's what I have. And if the bank would not give you that money, then you aren't going to have it. The testimony has been from Mr. Burris in here. He had $2 million to pay that off just in cash, if need be. Or he could give a letter of credit, which we would give. We never got the contract. We never got the contract. DeMont for Midland is supposed to finish that off, but there's no, we say we've got it, we can give it to you, but that's not what was holding this up. Not at all. That is not what held this up at all. We've been going for 5 years. We've been giving letters of credit. He's in good stead, and they'll give letters of credit as we keep on going. But a letter of credit also costs you money. When the bank does it, they charge a few thousand dollars for it. So they talked about alternatives of, you know, you don't just, once they do a letter of credit, the interest starts rolling and the money starts going. And so they talked about, we'll put up a CD for you and put it in Midland's name, and that's your security. You know, we can do it that way. That's another way done it. We can pay cash. What Dowling had done before, when they said a letter of credit, he goes, rather than just do that, I'll pay him. And he's paid the cash. Just, that's not a problem for this contract. It's absolutely, it wasn't till afterwards when we got in the litigation, they're going, well, we never actually did. But in the letter, they said to send it ASAP. But this is, and as Judge Devaney said, this is the custom and usage. Once you get that, you have 5 days to give a letter of credit.
What about the writing? And which document from Midland bound them to get you around the statute of frauds?
I think you put the three documents. The August 6th does where they say we have an agreement. And then you put it together with the July 23rd where they talk about you know, the 3 years, and then you put it together with the August 9th, which says 2013, 2014, 2015 at $70, $70 an acre. You take those three, and you've got the parties, you have the land, you have the price, and the term. It's all right there. They made the agreement orally on August 1st over the telephone, and that's where the meeting of the minds was, yes, we're going to do that.
Does the record indicate in those previous 5 years that they actually had written leases?
Yes. Yeah, they did. They did.
So
and they were always fulfilled by both parties, and it rolled along. And during that period of time, Dowling built up the soil. He's a very, very good, experienced farmer, and he works with agronomists. And why it's very important for him to get this three-year lease at the end is because he spent 5 years building this up. Now you get a three-year extension on the lease. You really get the benefit of building up your soil profile. It becomes more and more productive, and it has, in fact, became productive. And there's a document in there where the elder DeMont says, we are so pleased with you that if, in fact, we sold this, we would give you an extra $1 million because of what you've done on our farm. That's within months before this. And this was a good relationship. It all of a sudden comes into, it's a very old, old story, pure greed. And now you've got somebody in the way and somebody that needs to be thrown under the bus to get the $16 million. And they were willing to give a golden parachute. They never did anything that says, Mr. Dowling, you'll pay for this. And as it turns out, if it's supposed to be some benefit, 2013, and the court found it, we didn't make any money. Sure, you brought in all of this, but by the time you pay $2 million in rent, $600,000 in fertilizer, you're at the 2.6 that they went. They haven't talked about all the trucking, all the other costs that went into it, all the insurance costs that went into it, all of these other costs. And so,
all right, on those, first, was there evidence? I guess roughly I saw evidence of something in the neighborhood of $500,000 that Mr. Dowling said he could put the crop in for versus $1 million. That was in the evidence, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. Partly while we were talking about showing the expenses that he had were just way out of whack as to what was being done in the community.
All right. Well, didn't Mr. Dowling have some benefit from not having to spend that $500,000 to put, and I know you just said, well, he would have lost money, and Judge Devaney said that, but he lost less money if he didn't have to put the crop in.
Okay. He puts in what you ended up with a crop was rye infested. They didn't put in what he should have done to begin with the chemicals that were needed and the nitrogen that was needed. These fields were not tended at all like they were supposed to. They were supposed to put in clear field wheat, and they did in some places, but it's quite obvious that they didn't in others. We inherit a mess. When you have this, and I think of maybe as an analogy, a painter comes up to a homeowner and says, I want to paint your house. And he goes, I don't want you to paint my house. I'll paint it and do whatever. While the homeowner's gone, the painter comes. And he paints half the house. But you know what he paints? The bottom half of the house. And you come back and you go, what in the world is this? Now I've got a problem. Now I've got, and the house wasn't painted right to begin with, wasn't done right, and now I immediately have to spend money. Within the first week that Mr. Dowling gets on the property and it hasn't been fertilized and this whole thing's a mess, he's got to go out and get $605,000 worth of fertilizer, nitrogen, to go on over this. He's trying to start weed control in there. And so when you're talking about a benefit, there's some benefit, but when you get to the third test on does the benefit outweigh, and now we look at the equities, and that's what Judge Devaney said. And Judge Devaney said, yes, there was some benefit that was in there. But now when we get to the third test on unjust enrichment, you go, and balancing these of keeping this person off of his property for 7 months, farming only about a third of it, and then this mess that they had afterwards, then interfering with him trying to sell the hay afterwards, fighting over the insurance, and it was just a battle, an absolute battle for 1 year, and at the end of it, for the year, Mr. Dowling loses money, and a lot of money, and what the judge said afterwards was, Mr. Dowling, you lost money on an acre-by-acre basis. Had you have been entitled to farm the whole place, you basically would have lost more money. And so I find that there isn't a claim there. Mr. Dowling said, as a farmer, I would have handled this differently, even in spite of the weather. I can do this. I can plant the second crop, which we do all the time here with wheat's our first crop, and then I get that off, and then it's a break-even year for me on all of that, but I've got a second crop of sunflowers, and I get that second crop of sunflowers in the same growing year, and that's where I make my money and I make my profit. And the court said, that's just too speculative. And I'm not going to award you anything because on paper, you actually did lose money and whatever. So we're out on that part of it. But then they come back and go, we were unjustly enriched. No, you painted half the house. You gave us a problem on this and a problem that we had to just stick money and resources and time and work 7 days a week, except for Sunday morning, of just working, working, working to try to turn this into something.
Go ahead and finish.
For them to breach this contract, do this to a farmer who's been farming for 40 years, to do that, and then to come walking in afterwards and put their hand out, it takes some audacity and go, say, by the way, he put this weed in, we paid him back, which was something that they were doing for themselves to sweeten the deal so that Clement would still come in there because he was their sugar daddy with the $42 million. And so when he walks away from that, all of a sudden, he goes, I want my money back. I get all my money back at inflated prices. Oh, and another $100,000 on top, because that's what it says in there. Clement walks out of it.
What about Mr. Taylor's argument that the breach was too attenuated to the claim for unjust enrichment.
That the
breach was too attenuated to justify.
I couldn't disagree with him more. This breach, which took us off of the farm, which did not allow us to do our farming, put in the right kind of farming practices that make this. A farmer's not guaranteed a profit every year, of course not. And you get some insurance to cover some of your losses or whatever. But this breach is what started this whole problem. The breach and then being thrown off the property we've got a contract. We're talking contract and what name is going on it on the 9th. The 14th, we get the letter going, get off the property. We've already bought wheat seed for 300 and some thousand, a sprayer for 300 and some thousand, and have a whole crew harrowing out there thinking we have a contract. I can't disagree more with Mr. Taylor's part about that this is some kind of harmless breach. It goes right to the heart of this whole problem and why we're standing here 2 years later, almost 3 years later, on this matter.
Your time has expired. Thank you, Mr. Eastland.
Okay. Sorry, Your Honor, for doing it.
Hey, Mr. Taylor, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal, sir.
In the 46 years that Mr. Eastland and I have been friends, we've disagreed before, so I suppose we'll disagree again in this case. There are a couple of points that are really important to make. First of all, the nature of the farming operation. Mr. Dowling is not an unsophisticated guy. I think he farmed 68,000 acres the year 2012-2013 crop year. He testified that the Clearfield variety of wheat that he purchased, seed that he purchased in anticipation of planting this land, that he planted elsewhere. So it isn't exactly like he got beat out of $300,000 worth of Clearfield seed. Clement planted Clearfield variety seed. Clearfield variety seed it's not a GMO, but it's a seed that has been bred to be resistant to a certain type of weed spray. The ryegrass, wild ryegrass and winter wheat is always a problem, and Clearfield is a breed of wheat that you can spray over the top of to kill the ryegrass. Okay, so what really happened here? First of all, the Clement contract, this greedy contract with this $16 million profit that required rolling Dowling under the bus, contains a provision that says that if there's a lease in place with Dowling, he can farm it. Clement didn't care. Clement was already working 7 or 8 miles away with his crews. And an Iowa corn farmer, Clement testified in his deposition that for a number of years, he farmed North Dakota's largest wheat farm, 55,000 acres, inside of one fence, not dissimilar to this farm, and it was a wheat operation. So he's not an Iowa corn farmer who has no clue about what's going on in central South Dakota by any means. $100,000 for inconvenience? No. $100,000 for overhead. That's what's provided for in the agreement to pay Clement. Mr. Dowling testified that he could have planted that ground, 12,000 acres. Now remember, this is two-fifths of the total property. He could have planted that 12,000 acres for $580,000. But he also testified that $580,000 did not include his charge for overhead, which is 10% of revenue generated. He conceded both in his deposition and at the trial that his cost of planting that property would have been in the $800,000 range. So Clement is not a rough-edged farmer. What happened in this deal is that when Dowling recaptured possession in February, he had a decision to make, and the decision he had to make was, am I going to leave that winter wheat
and take the benefit of the $1 million that's been spent to plant that winter wheat, or am I going to turn to my landlord and say, you booted me out of here in August, and you did something out there, I don't care what you did, clean it up. Burn down the wheat? All of those options were available to Dowling, but he made a conscious decision. There's a stand of winter wheat, and it looks pretty good. If you look at the Federal Crop Insurance Adjuster's report, and if you look at what Clement said about the stand of wheat, in March and April, when it's decision time on what you're going to do with the ground, Clement said, looked pretty good. The crop insurance adjuster said, looked pretty good. So what happens then? He makes the decision. I'm going to keep that wheat and I'm going to fertilize it with nitrogen. Now, there are two ways you can raise winter wheat. One is you plant it in the fall, you put a starter fertilizer with it, which does not cost $600,000, costs about $100,000. And then in the spring, you assess the winter wheat and you say, how's this look? How did it come through dormancy? Is it going to go? Is it going to grow fillers and sprout to heads? I think it's going to go. Put the nitrogen on it now, the $600,000 investment. The other way to do it is you put the nitrogen on in the fall and you carry the nitrogen over into the spring. If the wheat's not going to go and you destroy it and plant something else, you still get the benefit of the nitrogen. Just two ways of looking at things. In our record, you'll see that those two ways of looking at how to raise the winter wheat are explained by our expert witness. Nothing unusual about any of this.
All right, Mr. Chair, going to what are you asking for in this case? I understand the unjust enrichment and the issues there. On the contract breach, what are you asking for?
If you ruled that Judge Devaney was incorrect in her assessment that there was a meeting of the minds, and if you said there was no contract, then the case is over. The unjust enrichment issue, there's no breach for Dowling to hang his hat on at that point and claim that the breach means that I don't have to pay for the seed. If you rule no contract, then Dowling owes the fair sum for the cost of completing the planting in the fall that he got the benefit of, and the case is over. So you rule that way, the case is over. There was no breach of contract. Dowling's been in possession of the land for a couple of years, but he's paid the rent, so it's a push. And the 2015 crop season is coming. If you made that decision today, then somebody else will farm the ground in 2015. That simple.
You're probably not going to get a bench decision.
Understand that. Understand that. A couple other points that are important to make. Negotiations over security. Sure, there were negotiations over security. $2 million rent. Mr. Dowling concedes that through the month of August, they were talking about security. Mr. Dowling says, oh, well, I can put up a CD. Well, why does he want to do that? Because it costs money to buy a letter of credit. You have to pay the banker to issue the letter of credit, A. B, $2 million letter of credit impinges your line of credit, your operating line of credit. That's $2 million that's earmarked for this letter of credit. That's $2 million you can't use to plant wheat in the fall of the year.
And all right, well, what does ASAP mean?
As soon as possible.
Well, I know that, but in this context, you're saying it breached. The contract with Mr. Clement said meant 5 days. Is that what ASAP means in this
context? I think what ASAP means in this case was never resolved. I think that that was a fundamental element of the contract of the parties that was never resolved. Mr. DeMott's testimony is, through the month of August, while he's negotiating, trying to come to terms with Dowling on whether or not they've got a deal, he's saying, what about the letter of credit? When do I get the letter of credit? ASAP.
Mr. Dowling's response is to say, well, I could give you a CD or I could do this, really resisting the idea of a letter of credit in the first place.
Well, isn't it, don't letters of credit normally come after there's a contract? How do you get a letter of credit unless you have the written contract?
Well, sure. The banker's going to say, I'm not going to issue a letter of credit to DeMont for $2 million unless you got a written lease in place in your hand, Mr. Dowling. Of course, that's the case. But one element of preparing that written contract is, am I going to get a letter of credit? When am I going to get the letter of credit? Is it going to secure the rental agreement? And that aspect of the agreement was never made, never got to that point. And there is no extrinsic evidence required to establish that. What is required is, show me the writing. Show me the writing, the combinations of emails, the notes on the back of an envelope that the parties agreed to, that settles this issue of the letter of credit. Didn't happen. No meeting of the minds, contract not fulfilled. And you know, Mr. Dowling does not deny that a letter of credit was a fundamental and material element of this case. He offers testimony then that he could supply it. He doesn't deny that. All the parties agree. What they disagree on is, was the deal made? Deal wasn't made. Before I have to sit down, I just want to talk for one moment about unjust enrichment. Mr. Dowling had 29,000 acres. 12,000 of them were planted. He derived revenue of $2.6 million off those 12,000 acres. He didn't pay the cost of planting those acres, $1 million. Unjust enrichment, to which, all things aside, DeMott's entitled. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Court will be in recess.